welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are happy that you're with us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit in Plains Folk, Dr. Tom Ezern reflects on Rethinking Rural, Volume 2, a collection of voices spanning science, higher education, and faith, ending with a nun's quiet but powerful belief that even in times of decline, new life can still rise across the Great Plains. And later, a report from Harvest Public Media exploring how community-supported agriculture is evolving. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and spring has finally arrived across North Dakota. And with it comes that annual question. What should we be doing right now to set up our lawns, our gardens, trees, and landscapes for success? From soil prep and pruning, from planting vegetables to choosing the right trees and shrubs, there's a lot to get into in a short window. Joining us is someone who's helped guide generations of gardeners across our region, Don Kinsler, horticulturalist with NDSU Extension in Cass County, a longtime garden columnist. Don, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. And when you think of it, this month of May for gardeners or everybody who enjoys their yards and gardens, there's a lot that happens during May. You know, at the beginning of May, things are barely starting to grow at all. And by the end of May, everything is in full leaf and our gardens and everything are planted. And so there's a lot that happens during this exciting spring month.
I think we're all just itching to get with it, not wanting to make the mistake of maybe jumping the gun. We had below freezing temperatures just this morning in Fargo. But what's the mindset we should have right now as we move into spring?
Well, the first part of May is a good transition time. You know, I never trust Mother Nature the first 10, 12, 15 days of May, because these frosts, chilly evenings, are very, very common until we get maybe closer towards the 12th to the 15th of May, depending on where you live. But the first part of May is kind of when we just enjoy watching the trees begin to leaf out and watch our perennials kind of come up through, and we can start preparing for our yard and garden. But this first earliest part of May is not really when we would start planting much. You know, when we talk about vegetables, there are some vegetables that we could get in. But I like to look at this first part of May as we enjoy watching everything unfold. You know, I'm enjoying watching the perennials come up, the established ones coming up out of the soil again for another growing season, and watching the trees and shrubs, the leaves starting to unfold. And because this first part of May here, the weather can be very, very chilly. These frosty evenings are very, very common. But now on the upside, it sounds dangerous, you have frost in early May, but our trees and shrubs that are starting to leaf out and also established perennials coming up through the ground, they're used to chilly. You know, perennials have come up through cold, chilly soil. And the leaves are coming out on nights that have been chilly, and so they're very tough. They're hardened off. They're used to these temperatures. So in early May here, when we get frosty nights, it doesn't faze them. You know, if we were going to get record cold of maybe 10 degrees, you know, that would be another situation.
Let's hope not, Don.
But we don't have to worry. Don't have to worry about when we get frosty nights on the things that are already established and are growing. But also, it's really too early for us to actually plant new things out. You know, it's too early for tomato plants. When we talk about vegetable gardens, you know, tomato plants too early because they would be nipped by frost. So I start in our own yard. I start kind of thinking as I'm watching everything develop. I'm starting to think now about what I want to plant in trees, shrubs, new perennials, annuals, the vegetable garden. So there's a little bit of a window of opportunity here to start planning. If anyone hasn't done their spring pruning yet, and actually the pruning of trees and shrubs is better done in spring than last fall. So there's still a little window in which we could do some trimming on trees and shrubs. Before they get too advanced would be better. Roses, right now is a perfect time to prune roses.
I want to ask you about soil, Don. It seems like that's the foundation of everything. Are you a fan of soil testing? And what should people be looking for in their soil at this point of the season?
You know, soil testing is very, very important. One of my coworkers likes to use the phrase that fertilizing, you know, of course, we all know that plants grow better if you give some fertilizer, either natural or synthetic. So we know that fertilizer is good. But my coworker likes to say that adding fertilizer to plants or soil without a soil test is kind of like adding a salt to soup without first testing or tasting it. So anyway, soil test is important. You don't need to do it every year, but every so often, and especially if you've never had a soil test done, it is important. What it indicates is the nutrition level of that soil. It indicates the organic matter content to kind of see if that soil is beneficial for roots and uptake of nutrients. So a couple of places that soil testing can be done. NDSU no longer has a soil testing lab, but there are other two good alternatives. And when you go on their website, it will indicate how to take the soil test, as well as where to mail it to and how much soil. It's, you know, probably a couple of cups. It's not a huge quantity. So University of Minnesota soil testing, you know, simply search that, University of Minnesota soil testing, or AgVise, AgVise in Northwood, North Dakota, also provide soil testing. The fee on both of those is quite economical, well worth it. And so you go on those sites, find out how to submit the sample, send it on in, you'll get a report back, and then you can base your fertilizing on that. Or maybe your soil is so rich it won't need extra fertilizer. Also, it'll indicate the organic matter. It will indicate if you're low in organic matter. So then the addition of compost, well-rotted manure, peat moss, and other things. And so, Craig, you mentioned things that we can be doing now. We can be amending our soil. Amending meaning we can add good organic material. So those of us that have a very heavy clay-type soil, the way to get that to be more mellow and workable, and also so the plants will grow better and not be so compacted, is to add organic matter to it. Also, for anyone who has sandy soil, the addition of organic matter to that will provide some moisture-holding component. So while we're waiting for the weather to get such that we can plant, we can be doing, like you mentioned, soil testing. Submit a soil test. We can be amending the soil, getting the soil all ready for spring planting, which will come in another couple of weeks, probably.
Don, what's the biggest mistake folks make when they're preparing their soil every spring? Many of us have a routine, whether it's grass clippings that we then use the rototiller with. What's the biggest mistake people make?
The biggest mistake is rototilling or working up the soil when it's too wet, especially heavy clay soil. And of course, I've made every mistake there is to make. And so a few years ago, it was just too wet. The wet period in spring just wouldn't let up. And so I rototilled our garden, and in Fargo here, it's quite heavy clay, very heavy clay. And so I rototilled it when it wasn't quite dry enough, and it created golf ball-sized clay chunks that didn't disintegrate until maybe midsummer. And I had a very difficult time of trying to make a seed bed out of hard golf ball-sized clay lumps. And so working that soil before it's time, there's kind of an old, good old method for determining if the soil is workable enough to dig or dry enough to dig or rototill. And that is to grab a handful of the soil, squish it in your hand, and then release your fingers. If that soil ball stays in a gooey clay lump, it's too wet to work. But if you can take and kind of disintegrate that handful of soil. You know, if it'll kind of break and crumble apart nicely, then it's probably mellow enough, the right amount of moisture, dryness to go ahead and rototill or work. And so that hand test is really a good, pretty good indicator of whether it's you can go ahead and work it. Many people now have also been moving towards a no-till gardening, such as, you know, no-till farming, then use those practices for no-till vegetable gardening. And in heavy clay soil, it takes a few years to kind of transition to that. But what no-till gardening means is that you basically keep the layer of soil covered with mulch, and so it kind of becomes more mellow as the microorganisms kind of work and make a good soil environment that's not quite as gooey. And I still rototill. You know, I'm kind of a fan of rototilling the garden, but a part of it, I'm transitioning to the newer trend for no-till gardening.
Enjoying my conversation with Don Kinsler, horticulturalist with NDSU Extension in Cass County and a periodic guest with us here on Main Street. We love the expertise that he brings to our lawn and garden. Let's talk about lawns. Don, I went out. I just couldn't wait. Mowed my yard on Sunday. A couple neighbors had beat me to it a week or two earlier. Am I jumping the gun or is this the right time?
Well, as we kind of drive around our neighborhoods and look at lawns, one thing that is very evident in early May is some lawns green up much quicker than others. And sometimes it depends on what was done last fall. Lawns that were fertilized last September, kind of on the recommended date, those tend to green up quicker and start growing faster. So the recommended season-long mowing height is 3 to 3.5 inches. So if a person's lawn in spring starts getting above that point, and at that point it could start kind of toppling over a little, so when a person's lawn needs mowing, we should mow it. Now, the first mowing can be a little shorter. I've already mowed ours actually twice. The first mowing can be a little shorter just to kind of grind up leaves and clean it up. But then fairly soon after that, such as the second or third mowing, we should already raise the mowing height to that 3 to 3.5 inches. That mowing height has been shown to be the best mowing height for lawns to create the best, healthiest, kind of maintenance-free lawn. It still looks very, very neat. Mowing short, such as shorter than the 3 inches, has been shown to be detrimental to the lawn. It the roots don't grow as deeply. It doesn't fill sideways as much. And, you know, when we think of it, it's kind of all about science. You know, we've all heard about photosynthesis on green leaves, you know, from our grade school and high school biology classes. And so if you have a grass blade that's 3, 3.5 inches, it has more leaf surface, more green chlorophyll, so more photosynthesis, than one that is cut or scalped quite low. And so the nice thing is, by keeping it at that little bit higher mowing height all summer long, the lawn becomes healthier, and then we don't need to put quite as much inputs into it. It actually requires less water because you shade the roots a little more. It tends to crowd out weeds more, so we don't need as much herbicide and chemicals applied. So anyway, that's my long-winded spiel on the first mowing can be a little shorter, but then raise it up to the 3 to 3.5 inches. And so, no, if a person's lawn needs mowing this time of year, we go ahead and mow it, not to cut too short.
I remember you told me, Don, at least I think I remember this right, that if you don't do anything else to your lawn, aerate it. That's what you need to do. Is that still your recommendation, and when should you do it?
Aerating a person's lawn is quite important, especially if the lawn is heavy heavy soil, and the Red River Valley, of course, it is, and also if there's been much foot traffic in areas. That can compress soil, and so aeration, there's two different operations. Core aeration lifts up all the little plugs of soil and the thatch and kind of opens up that turf so that the fertilizer and air and water can penetrate better. And the other operation that's commonly done is dethatching, also known as power raking. And so that can get rid of some of that excess thatch also. Now, if a person, if one's lawn is kind of breaking down that thatch naturally, it's not always imperative to do an aeration or a dethatching. But if your lawn looks kind of thin and not really growing the way it is, then the, as you mentioned, Craig, aeration or power raking can open up that profile to let good things get down into the root system.
I bought some sandal-like devices last year, Don, that have these nails kind of beneath it. And the instructions are to walk over your yard. Is that a good idea?
Yes, aerating as you're walking.
Okay. Don, is there a better time to aerate your yard? I seem to have seen it done pretty much year round in summer and fall.
In the spring of the year, it is important for aeration to wait until the lawn is actively growing in May. If we did it too early while the lawn is not actively growing, we can actually damage the lawn because the aeration and power raking are fairly aggressive. So it can physically tear up some of the grass plants if it's done too early and the lawn is still too moist. So a target time would be middle of May on. The last half of May is great. Can also be done in August and September also.
When should we begin fertilizing? If we want to fertilize three times a year or so, if that's kind of been our routine, is there a better time to start?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. Because the old way of thinking was to fertilize lawns early, you know, to kind of get them to green up. But turf research in the meantime has shown that the time that the grass plants can use the fertilizer most effectively is towards the end of May, when the lawn is already green and growing, and then the roots of the lawn grass can immediately take up the fertilizer. So a target date in spring is around Memorial Day. That's been shown to be the most beneficial time. If a person fertilizes earlier, it's not going to kill the lawn, obviously, but the lawn might not be quite ready to use all that. And if we got a lot of rain, some of that fertilizer might be washed down the drain. So Memorial Day is the target date for spring. And in the fall, very important, around Labor Day. If a person were to give your lawn one fertilizing per year, the Labor Day in September has been shown to be the most effective time, actually. And then secondary Memorial Day. And if one's lawn is irrigated, then a fertilizing in midsummer can be done too. Or if one doesn't water your lawn, as I don't, and it's not actively growing in the middle of summer, then that midsummer fertilizing can be skipped.
Is springtime the best time if I need a little part of my yard, I need to patch or reseed a little bit? Is this the time, or are we still a little bit early to hop on that patching up our yard?
We're right on the verge. We're a little bit early yet for grass seeding, but it'll come quickly. And the reason why we're on the verge, soil is still a little chilly. We've had a lot of chilly days. It's not been a warm spring. And the soil temperature, in order for grass seed to sprout, needs to be up to about 55 degrees or so. And otherwise, if a person seeds too early, the sparrows and other birds will clean up the majority of the grass seed. And so it pays to wait just a little. Again, we're on the verge. The grass seed spread now might not germinate. But, you know, again, we're probably a week early on that. But otherwise, May is a great time. And the single most important key to getting a good stand of grass, whether it's new lawn or you're filling in weak kind of bare spots in the lawn, is to keep that area what I call dark moist. You know, if you're overseeding into a lawn, you kind of need to, with a heavy garden rake, kind of stir up those dead patches so that the seed actually can contact down in, or spread a little bit of bagged topsoil over those areas so there's actually some soil there that the grass seed can land on, and then keeping it dark moist. You know, soil that's drying out is a little lighter in color, so keeping it dark moist, which might mean watering in the morning and evening. But that one thing is the key to success. If the grass, if the soil starts to dry out a little bit as that grass seed is sprouting, it can easily be killed.
Let's talk about trees and shrubs, Don. What should homeowners, I guess, be doing right now relative to those trees that have been in our yard a long time? You mentioned pruning. It's a good time to do that. Is there anything else that we should do relative to watering or even fertilizing for our trees and shrubs? And if we want to plant some new trees, is now a good time or is it still a little bit early?
It is really a good time. Again, we're just on the verge of the time. I would wait on planting new trees and shrubs until it looks like we're not going to have frost in the evenings. So again, I kind of look at the time period from maybe the 10th of May onward when there's chances of frost are less likely. So that's a good planting window. Now, the nice thing on our big established shade trees, they've got immense root systems. So in the spring, there's really little that we need to do. On a younger tree that was maybe planted within the last 7 to 10 years and is still kind of growing up and establishing, the best thing that we can do for those trees is to put a circle of wood mulch around to prevent the grass from out-competing that little tree. And so a circle about 3 to 5 foot in diameter and about 3 to 5 inches thick. One thing that I do as an underlayment under that circle of mulch, I lay cardboard, just plain brown, undyed cardboard, overlapped in a circle around the tree, kept a little bit away from the trunk, and then I put the wood, the bark or shredded bark mulch over that. And what that does is it prevents the grass from robbing all the nutrients and moisture from that developing tree. So you can almost double the rate of growth of a young tree, including fruit trees, by that mulch. Also, it makes mowing and trimming much easier with less chance of damaging the tree. When you're buying new trees, the main thing to check is that it's hardy enough, winter hardy enough for our area. And so check the tag. We in North Dakota, Minnesota are in zone 4, and also the northern tier of counties across both states is zone 3. So check the tag. We could do zone 4, 3, 2, 1. 1 is way up by the Arctic Circle. So check to make sure that a new tree or shrub that you have in mind or a perennial flower is suited for our winter hardiness zone.
Don, I have some bare root bushes that I've planted the last couple of years that are doing pretty well, but a couple of them have the grass creeping in. I didn't do a good job of doing what you just described. Can I go over the top of that grass with that mulch right now and then lay the mulch down with the cardboard underneath and ultimately then that grass would die? Or do I need to clear that grass out and then leave the cardboard down?
Well, the nice thing is you can lay the cardboard directly on the grass. That's a great technique called smothering. And the grass will just turn into kind of nice organic material underneath. So, yep, the cardboard can go right down over the existing grass around a tree or around a shrub, right down on the existing grass, overlap it good so there's no way for the grass to kind of work its way up through the seams, overlap it generously. And then the mulch. So the grass does not have to be removed. On all of our trees, I just lay the cardboard right over the top of grass.
I want to turn to vegetable gardening. You mentioned it's a little bit early, but for beginners who are thinking about having a vegetable garden, maybe for the first time, what are the easiest vegetables to grow successfully here in our area?
Oh, we're in a great vegetable growing area. And the vegetables we plant can be divided into two groups, cool season vegetables and warm season vegetables. And as the name implies, the cool season vegetables, they will sprout in chilly, cool soil. They'll also tolerate some frost. So those can be planted already, even maybe late April. In that category are things like peas, spinach, lettuce, carrots, kale, radishes. On the other side of the spectrum are the warm season crops. Those are the vegetables that need warm soil in order to grow, and they'll also be killed at 32 degrees or colder. So in that group are the tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, cucumbers, squash, melons. All of those we need to wait. So the cool season crops could go in late April, early May. Then we wait with the warm season crops until the danger of frost has passed and the soil has warmed. So those are more towards maybe the 20th to the 30th of May. When you hear our grandparents and parents talking about how they never put gardening in until Memorial Day, and that's a safe time to put everything in. Sometimes things delayed a little bit until the soil is warm. Those vegetables will just spring into life in that warm soil. But if you get kind of the itch, you can do cool season and then wait for the warm season vegetables.
Don, as we wrap up our conversation today, what are you most excited to plant or work on in your own garden this spring?
I am excited about new types of flowers for containers. You know, and many of us, whether it's in front of our patios, our front doorstep, the backyard deck, we love planting flowers in containers all around town. And there are so many new, unique flowers that greenhouses have for containers. My wife, Mary, and I just bought, we aren't going to plant them yet for another probably 10 days or so, but my wife and I bought some of the beautiful new petunias with the intense colors, and they were developed specially for pots and planters. They're absolutely beautiful. And I'm trying a new tomato, new to me. I think it's been on the market for a couple of years, called Super Sauce. Super Sauce. They can get 1 to 2 pound tomatoes, and they're very meaty, you know, for salsas and canning. And of course, my favorite tomatoes are Big Beef and Celebrity. So I'm anxious to get even some of my tried and true vegetables and flowers planted as well.
Don, how can people learn more about your work with NDSU Extension?
You can certainly send me an email, donald.kinzler, spelled K-I-N-Z-L-E-R, at ndsu.edu, or a quick online search for NDSU Cass County Horticulture should bring up a number of webinar recordings that I've done as well.
That's Don Kinzler, horticulturalist with NDSU Extension in Cass County. He helps gardeners across the region get the most out of our growing season. Don, thanks so much for your time and expertise. We really appreciate it when you're with us on Main Street.
Well, thank you, Craig, and thanks everyone. And let's all enjoy a very great spring.
Hear, hear. Still to come on Main Street Plainsfolk with Dr. Tom Ezern, New Life Will Rise on the Prairie, plus a report from Harvest Public Media on community-supported agriculture. It's changing as farms add flexible payments, customization, and convenience. That's still ahead on Main Street, right after this news. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. In this edition of Plainsfolk, Dr. Tom Ezern takes us into a morning fill-up conversation in Rapid City, where big questions about rural life are brewed over coffee and gathered into a new collection, Rethinking Rural, Volume 2. With voices ranging from science to education to faith, Dr. Ezern zeroes in on what these perspectives reveal and what they miss about the future of the Great Plains.
There's this group of people that gathers now and then in a converted gas station in Rapid City for what they call the morning fill-up. The agenda is to have a conversation with some interesting thinker with ideas about life in rural America, to have a national conversation within the context of the Great Plains. Now and then, the contributions are gathered into a book and published by North Dakota State University Press. So now we have Rethinking Rural, Volume 2, with the subtitle Reflections on Changing Communities. It's an anthology with multiple voices, including, among others, a physicist writing about how rural communities produce scientists and are affected by them. A Lakota, Cheyenne River, former tribal chairman, speaking to the shared characteristics of rural people on reservation and off. A health administrator making the case for new models to deliver medical services. An energy utility manager posing public utilities as models for regional community. College officials sketching a plan for delivery of higher education to neglected quarters. And a Benedictine nun contemplating the future of the Great Plains. How do you review a book like that? Well, let me focus on three contributions. Nigel Lockyer, a physicist from Cornell, invokes a traditional trope, the idea that prairie boyhood or girlhood is good preparation for intellectual and scientific achievement. Rural America at present, though, is totally different, he says, from the environment that propelled Ernest Lawrence from rural South Dakota toward a Nobel Prize. It has hollowed out, but there remains the potent appeal of lifestyle, recreation, nature, open spaces. Modern science, he says, offers solutions that change how we work and where we live. Now, Lockyer is talking about hybrid employment, that sort of thing. He says, too, rural America needs science and all that it brings. All that it brings. I don't share his faith. I'll keep reading. Amy Novak and Joe Royd, a couple of academic administrators, recount a venture in mixed-format delivery intended to bring higher education to Pierre, South Dakota, a state capital without a college or university. Trouble is, it seems to me, their vision comprises only skill-specific job training desired by local employers. This seems reductionist to me. Call me crazy, but I like the land-grant university ideal of education for whatever career a person desires, and also for life and citizenship, too. I know that is an ideal never fully met, but it seems the model here posed values people only as workers with certain skills. It seems, too, to say that if you live in Pierre or Ellendale, you have to accept a less elevated life. So, reading on, and I come to this remarkable essay, The Land, by Sister Lorraine Coffin, a Benedictine nun born in 1933. She grew up on a West River ranch, and we can speculate just what led to her monastic vows, but it wasn't distaste for the life into which she was born. We kids roamed the countryside, she writes. They hid in plum thickets, marveled at the skies. Our land had personality, she says, and families looked out for one another. Then came all the changes post-World War II, along with her embrace of a life of teaching and monastic management. And she witnessed, in her holy order, the same declensionist trends that affected the countryside. Some people had the idea that a monastery would continue forever, she concludes. Our community was coming to an end. It is hoped that new life will arise on the prairie. Are you praying for that, sister? Should we all be doing so? Sister Lorraine's essay in Rethinking Rural is the conversation I would most like to extend.
Plainsfolk is a regular feature on Main Street, written and presented by Dr. Tom Ezern, North Dakota State University Distinguished Professor of History. Today's essay, New Life Will Arise, reflects on Rethinking Rural, Volume 2, and the enduring question of what comes next for rural communities. More Plainsfolk's essay are available on our website at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
K Community Supported Agriculture, or CSA boxes, first gained popularity in the 90s. It's a way for people to support their local farmers. They pay upfront for produce delivered throughout the summer. But today's food system caters to both convenience and choice. As Harvest Public Media's Hope Kerwin reports, that's put pressure on CSA farmers to offer people more buying options.
Patty Grimmer ticks off the trays of seedlings in one of the greenhouses on her farm in southern Wisconsin.
Yeah, so we got peppers, we've got some lettuce mix that's going to be transplanted out in our field, our tomatoes.
All of this produce will go to regional farmers markets, restaurants, and customers who signed up for a community-supported agriculture, or CSA share. In most CSAs, members pay several hundred dollars at the start of the year and receive a weekly box of produce throughout the spring and summer. But Grimmer lets her members sign up for shorter time frames, as little as 1 month, and they can opt to pay as they go instead of all at once. Some old-school farmers may say that's not CSA, but Grimmer sees it as a needed evolution to the original model.
We're transitioning to a generation of convenience, of preference. You know, you can get your groceries delivered to you in a matter of hours while you sit on your couch and pick what you want to pick.
She's a part of a growing number of CSA farmers who are offering more flexibility to their members to keep up with consumer preferences. Sadie Willis is with Fair Share CSA Coalition, which serves farms throughout the Midwest. She says producers who are offering more flexibility still see themselves as supported by their community of customers.
Even if those customers are saying, hey, I want to pick up my box at my local brewery instead of having to drive over to your farm to get it, or I don't like kohlrabi, can you give me more spinach instead? So like some of those components have come into play over time where consumers are being a little bit more choosy.
She says farms can use a number of online platforms to let CSA members swap out items in their weekly box. Producers can also shift to a credit system, where customers load an online card at the start of the season and choose whether to buy something each week. But these customer conveniences move the model away from what it was meant to do for farms. John Hendrickson is a farm viability specialist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Back in the early 90s, he helped organize some of the first CSA memberships at farms in the Madison area. Hendrickson says traditionally, CSA was about people taking on the risk with farmers. But that doesn't work for every consumer.
You know, if the farm had a bad year and there were not as many tomatoes, then people got less tomatoes. You know, most consumers are not in a position to roll the dice on in terms of their food budget. And so that has really kind of fallen by the wayside.
He says CSA has always required more customer service than selling in bulk or at a market stand. Letting consumers customize their weekly box could create even more administrative work for a farmer who would rather be in their field. It's why some farmers, like Liz Graysneck in central Missouri, are taking a more conservative approach to customer flexibility. She lets her members pay in installments instead of upfront, but they don't have the option of canceling mid-season. Customers can tweak their weekly box when the farm has an abundance of a certain vegetable, but Graysneck says she's not interested in becoming a subscription service.
That does not fit what CSA is. You know, for me, CSA embodies eating seasonally, supporting the farm that is feeding you, and I'm not Amazon, you know?
She thinks farmers have to find the right balance between serving new kinds of customers and staying true to the whole point of community-supported farming. I'm Hope Kerwin, Harvest Public Media.
This story is part of Harvest Public Media's Food Roots series.
Curious minds make happy campers at North Dakota's Gateway to Science in Bismarck. Summer camp registration is now open, with week-long adventures running May 26th through August 14th. Campers explore science, technology, engineering, and math through hands-on experiments, creative problem-solving, and activities, all in a fun, supportive environment where friendships and confidence grow. Offering morning or afternoon half-day camps or full-day options to fit your summer schedule. More information and registration can be found online at gatewaytoscience.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
Another Strait is closing. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Scientists are very concerned about the Atlantic Ocean's circulation system that affects weather in huge parts of the world.
The Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, appears more likely to collapse than previously thought and could have catastrophic consequences for Europe, Africa, and the Americas.
AMOC moves water from the southern Atlantic to the north, where it cools and sinks. Because of this circulation, the climate in Europe is milder than in parts of Canada at the same latitude.
Based on direct observations, a study from the University of Miami concludes that the current has been weakening, which could lead to more extreme storms, changes in rainfall patterns, and colder winters in some areas. It could also raise sea levels along coastlines.
Previous computer modeling has predicted the changes, but this study shows actual measurements. The scientists used monitors on the seafloor along the North Atlantic to show a 20-year decline in the strength of AMOC. They add that this may serve as an early warning, like a canary in a coal mine.
Human-caused climate change is blamed for the circulation slowing. If the AMOC weakens further, it could reach a tipping point, then switch off, and might not turn on again for thousands of years.
While much attention has been paid to the aridification of the Colorado River Basin, other parts of the country are suffering from low precipitation.
Georgia, Florida, and South Carolina have been experiencing the most severe category of drought, with the Southeast now being called ground zero for some of the worst dryness in the country.
The National Weather Service describes these conditions as a 100-year event that can cause critical water emergencies, agricultural losses, wildfires, and profound ecosystem damage.
Parts of the Southeast have been in drought since last July. In March and April this year, the area received less than 25% of its normal precipitation.
Temperatures have been warmer than usual, which has dropped relative humidity, and a high pressure system has prevented the formation of clouds and precipitation.
This system was brought on by a northward bend in the jet stream, the fast-moving current of air several miles above Earth, which produced southeasterly winds and created ideal conditions for wildfires.
The spread of fire in the region has been fueled by leftover debris from hurricanes that have struck the region, like Helene in 2024, that rapidly intensified over the ocean, where temperatures were warmer, likely because of climate change.
Goldfish are an iconic first pet for many children and a common classroom companion. While they may look harmless and sweet in an aquarium, they can take down entire lake ecosystems should they get loose in the wild.
A new study from the University of Toledo and the University of Missouri found goldfish, which can get nearly 2 feet long when not confined to a tank, can trigger dramatic ecological collapse in freshwater lakes, threatening native species and the entire food web.
The researchers introduced goldfish, which are related to carp, into two experimental lake types, one nutrient-poor and the other nutrient-rich.
The results were stark. Water quality degraded rapidly as the fish churned up bottom sediments.
Native species like snails and small invertebrates, which form the foundation for healthy aquatic ecosystems, declined as they fell prey to the goldfish, had their habitats destroyed, or suffered as they competed for food.
A regime shift, the scientific term for when an ecosystem rapidly reorganizes into something fundamentally different and often worse, was documented in their study. Once triggered, the team says these shifts are notoriously difficult and expensive to reverse.
So, if you have a goldfish that you've outgrown, the researchers say to return it to the pet store or find a friend who's willing to adopt it. And finally, by now, everyone has heard that the Strait of Hormuz is closed because of the U.S.-Israeli war against Iran, but there's another strait that could be closing, which would block shipping traffic between the Mediterranean Sea and the Atlantic Ocean in about 20 million years.
The Strait of Gibraltar sits between Europe in southern Spain and Africa in Morocco, connecting the Atlantic to the Mediterranean. At its narrowest, it's only around 13 kilometers or 9 miles wide.
A computer model by the University of Lisbon says things are shifting, tectonically speaking, and that the plate beneath the Strait of Gibraltar may be slowly sliding toward the Earth's interior in a process called subduction.
According to the Geological Society of America, subduction zones have more seismic and volcanic activity. Currently, the Atlantic Ocean has fewer subduction zones than the Pacific, which has the active and famous Ring of Fire. So any geologic activity around the strait gets the attention of researchers, and, they say, should also warrant the attention of countries in the region.
Although subduction in the strait is probably creeping along at 2 inches per year, it still raises the risk for earthquakes, landslides, and tsunamis. Scientists advise that now is the time for stricter building codes, emergency planning, and public awareness campaigns.
Since 2013, This Week in Water has been your Rock of Gibraltar on water and climate news. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Alzheimer's Association Minnesota North Dakota, working with ND Dementia Care Services to offer programs like the Empowered Caregiver Series. Learn more at alz.org/MNND/education-programs.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 5th. Mail order catalogs are nothing new. They've been a staple of Americana for well over a century. Perhaps the most famous is the Sears catalog. Starting in 1888, Sears Roebuck & Company has sold an amazing array of items, from coal stoves to video games, power tools to ready-to-assemble homes. Yes, homes. For over 30 years, Sears was in the housing business, and it was on this date in 1914 that Mr. and Mrs. Gullickson of Cartwright, North Dakota, ordered their Hazelton model house. For the price of $1,525.37, the Gullicksons bought a home featuring 2 bedrooms, a parlor, dining room, kitchen, indoor bathroom, and 2 porches. It even included nails, gutters, and painting materials. It took a while for the house to arrive via train, ferry, and even rowboat, and assembly was required. The Gullicksons were not the only Americans ordering homes from Sears. Some 100,000 houses were sold by the Chicago-based company. Sears entered the housing market in the 1890s by selling the raw building materials. However, the department struggled and was almost shut down until a former manager of the porcelain department thought of retooling the approach. Instead of just selling building materials, Sears started selling entire homes. Selecting from the Sears Modern Homes catalog, customers could pick the house of their dreams and even customize the blueprints. Sears shipped everything the homeowner needed: pre-cut lumber, drywall, shingles, construction plans, nails, and even varnish. The company boasted that the material was of the finest quality, and the prefabrication cut building time by 40%. Furthermore, Sears offered a liberal 5-year financing plan with 6% interest. However, Sears' marketing plan eventually backfired. The homes were at the height of popularity when the Great Depression hit. Sears was left holding $11 million in liquidated mortgages, as homeowners were no longer able to keep up with their payments. The Sears housing department struggled on for another 11 years, until 1940, when Sears shipped its last model home. And although Sears is no longer in the housing business, the Gullickson home and many others are still in use. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lane Sunwall. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
And that's it for this Tuesday's Main Street. We're deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, spring foraging and flavor with Chef Candace Stock. Chef Stock joins Prairie Place to explore the art of spring foraging, cooking with wild ingredients, and her latest work at the soon-to-be-open Theodore Roosevelt Presidential Library. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we look forward to your joining us again.